Tackling Britain's Terror Problem. Today, Friday, August 29th. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. The UK raises its terror threat alert from substantial to severe. Security officials are especially worried about British-based militants returning from Syria or Iraq. British Prime Minister David Cameron says his country needs to cut off the danger.
We need to tackle that ideology of Islamist extremism head-on, at root, before it takes the form of violence and terror.
We'll have the latest. Also today, some Haitian women resort to DNA testing to track down the UN peacekeepers who fathered their babies. And later, Hello Kitty and her offshoots.
Hello Kitty Fender guitars. Hello Kitty motor oil. Hello Kitty makeup by Sephora.
Those stories and more after the news.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. Remember the color-coded terror alert system that was created post-9/11? We don't hear about it much these days, at least not here in the U.S. But over in Britain, they raised their national threat level today to severe. Officially, that means a terrorist attack on the United Kingdom is now considered to be highly likely. British authorities won't talk about specific intelligence about any pending attack, but they do say that the higher alert has everything to do with the extremist group known as ISIS. Prime Minister David Cameron says that at least 500 people have traveled from the UK to fight in Syria or Iraq.
We need to tackle that ideology of Islamist extremism head on, at root, before it takes the form of violence and terror. That means challenging the thinking of extremist ideologues, identifying the groups in this country that push an extremist agenda, and countering them by empowering the overwhelming majority who believe in British values of democracy, the rule of law, and respect for minorities.
We have our BBC colleague Dominic Casciani on the line with us from London. He's a security analyst. And Dominic, how big of a deal is this decision to raise the terror threat?
I think, Carol, this is a pretty big deal here in London, particularly for the security officials behind the scenes. But I think for the general public, it's very, very difficult to compute what's going on here and really make sense of it. Let me talk you through how it really works. This terror threat level system used to be super secret in the UK, but it was one of the decisions of former Prime Minister Tony Blair's government to try and be a little bit more open about this. This was during the days when he was trying to stand shoulder to shoulder with America on the all sorts of matters like Afghanistan and Iraq. What the threat level does is give us an idea, an indication, a brief glimpse into the minds of security officials so that when, as today, they say they're raising it to severe, what they're saying is they're amassing an awful lot of intelligence from the British security agencies. Some of that information may be coming from their partners in Washington and putting that information together, and it's building a picture of something that is really concerning them. Now, the picture that's really concerning them at the moment is Syria and Iraq and the number of British fighters who've gone out there to join that Syrian jihad being led by the so-called Islamic State. That's really what's going on.
Now, I know there's been a lot of focus in Britain since the execution video of James Foley, and the executioner himself had a British accent. Any indication that the increasing the terror alert has to do with evidence or information they found from investigating that person's voice or other Britons who are in Syria?
Well, the investigation is being kept under a really tight lid at the moment. My understanding is that it's been led by the security service MI5, effectively our internal version of the FBI. We understand that there has been significant progress, but it's real speculation to try and work out what that means. What we do know is that there are so many British people who have gone out to Syria. The government estimates about 500 to 600 people who have gone out there, that the security service have a good idea about the lives of some of these people, not least because a lot of them are putting their activities on social media networks like Twitter. But also at the same time, there's an awful lot of people who've gone out there who they didn't have a great deal of an idea about. I was talking to one senior police officer earlier this week who told me that nearly half of those who'd left Britain to go to Syria, they hadn't heard of. So if they have identified the man who was involved in this beheading, they're not saying, and I think they're not saying for very good reason, because they don't want to compromise the investigation, in particular any possible attempt to apprehend people in the field which would be led by the American authorities.
Now, Prime Minister David Cameron said he's going to introduce new laws for dealing with terrorism suspects. What's he talking about?
This is a real big debate here at the moment in London. For the past 2 weeks, we've had ministers talking about the need for new powers. A couple of years ago, the UK had a very controversial form of house arrest, which was used to keep some terrorism suspects effectively within their own homes for up to 16 hours a day. They weren't allowed to travel, use mobile phones, use the internet, these kind of things. Now, that power was watered down a few years ago and is now no longer used. Issue with Syria at the moment has led to many new calls for those powers to be resurrected and for new powers to be created. Now, one of the things the Prime Minister talked about today was a new and improved power to withhold passports, to stop Britons using the British passport to leave the country and to go to Syria. He's going to announce more details of that next week in Parliament. But there's a real debate about the types of powers the government could use.
BBC security analyst Dominic Casciani in London. There's no indication that the U.S. plans to raise its terror alert level, but the threat posed by militants in Syria and Iraq is one of two global issues at the top of President Obama's agenda right now. The other is the conflict in Ukraine and what to do about Russian troops fighting there. Yesterday, Obama said the U.S. would not act militarily in Ukraine, but Ukrainian officials are desperate for military help, and they hope it will come from NATO, the military alliance that includes the U.S. and much of Western Europe. Today, Ukraine's prime minister announced plans to seek full NATO membership for his country. I asked the BBC's David Stern in Kiev to explain.
What is happening is the government has said that they're going to submit legislation which would annul Ukraine's non-aligned status. They're not allowed to join any military alliance. And so they'll do that. Now, we'll see exactly what's in the legislation. Perhaps there will be a formal request. But then again, that's a formal request is a long and drawn out process. And there is, as we know, mixed feelings or mixed opinions, I guess you could say, about Ukraine joining the bloc.
But practically, if Ukraine gets that first step of nullifying its current status, can it ask for actual direct help from NATO, or does it have to go through the laborious thing of becoming a full member before potentially NATO could intervene and help in the crisis in eastern Ukraine?
Well, I don't think that's what the Ukrainians are looking for right now. Now, they say that they want to join NATO because of the situation in the east. But at the moment, everyone recognizes that there's not going to be any, so to speak, boots on the ground in Ukraine. At the very most, and even then they may not get this, they would like what's known as, they're getting non-lethal equipment. That's night goggles and flak jackets and meals ready to eat, things that you can't kill people with.
From NATO?
What they would like is... Where they get, as far as I understand, they're getting it from the United States and from individual nations. And individual nations apparently can make the decision to provide equipment. So NATO is not giving it as much support as perhaps the Ukrainians would like. But then again, it's a big step for NATO to step forward like this.
At least from the outside, a lot of countries and President Obama and lots of people are expressing verbal support for Ukraine, excoriating Vladimir Putin and Russia, but no one's stepping up to offer direct help. Is there a sense in Kiev that this is just going to be one big slow motion train wreck?
I think it already is a slow motion train wreck. I mean, it's a war by degrees. And the Russians have been slowly raising the heat. The analogy of choice is like a frog in a pan of water. It just seems that each week gets worse and worse. Now, there is the West does or is doing something, and the sanctions apparently are having an effect. The question is, short of actual military intervention or short of actually supplying the Ukrainians with serious weapons, and that's another issue. And there are any number of things that need to be discussed before that happens. But short of that, what can the West do? It seems that Moscow is going forward no matter what. And the question is really, what can the West do that's ultimately causes enough pain further down the road so that Moscow changes its mind. But right now, they're from all appearances, sending at least fighters into Ukraine and possibly even actual troops.
The BBC's David Stern speaking to us from Kiev. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
One man who's been working hard to verify military movements and weapons in eastern Ukraine is Elliot Higgins. He's a weapons researcher and the founder of Bellingcat, and he's been trying to find out where and what kind of weapons are being used in eastern Ukraine. What sources are you looking at to monitor what's going on in Ukraine?
Well, there's a variety of sources. A lot of it comes through social media accounts belonging to various people inside Ukraine and also in Russia as well. It's kind of a process I've developed whilst tracking the conflict in Syria, where you try to gather all this information together and try and turn it into some kind of order. With Syria, because you've got a very limited internet access, you kind of have YouTube channels that belong to one town or Twitter accounts that belong to one unit. The thing with Ukraine, because there's so many, the internet hasn't been cut off, everyone has free access to the internet, so the information's all over the place. So it's actually quite a lot harder to track the information coming from Ukraine.
What are you still confused about in the situation in Ukraine? What are you still trying to clarify?
Well, really, it's kind of the positions of where people are, where units are positioned. And, you know, there's certain incidents that do seem like Russia's firing from over the border into Ukraine. And that's been going on for several weeks now. So that's quite interesting. And finding little bits of evidence that point towards that is something I've been keeping an eye out for.
Now, you're independent. You famously started out doing this from your sofa. But now you're considered an expert. What have you learned from watching war through your screen?
One thing I've learned is how information from wars can be gathered in a new way now. It's not just, you know, you don't have to be some CIA agent on top of a hill in the middle of a dusty desert spying on a camp. Now, you know, if you want to see what jihadists are doing, you just look at their sort of YouTube accounts and their Twitter accounts because they post everything online. You know, recently we've seen so much information coming from the Islamic State. We've been able to identify one of their training camps in Mosul in Iraq, for example. So there's a lot more information out there that can be analysed and turned into kind of useful intelligence, and that can be acted on by, you know, journalists on the grounds, like we did with Ukraine and the MH17. We can also use that to, you know, help human rights organizations kind of direct their efforts.
So you see the value of your information. You mentioned the Malaysian Airlines that was shot down in eastern Ukraine. You're posting it in a sort of open way, and you want people to use it, whether it's an intelligence agency or a journalist.
Yeah, so for example, with MH17, we had a number of photographs and videos that showed the missile launch that was linked to the attack in various locations. And, you know, by sharing that information online and working with people collaboratively, we were able to locate exactly where these pictures and videos were filmed. And then based off that, we were able to actually figure out the route it travelled. And using shadows, we could actually tell the time of day. So we actually began to put together a timeline of where this actual missile launcher was during the day of the attack.
Now, in recent days, you've been trying to figure out where journalist James Foley was killed. Do you worry about ethics or your own security or the security of others in posting this material?
Well, in the case of the James Foley analysis, I actually purposely blanked out everything except the train. So James Foley, the flag of ISIS, I blanked that all out, and all I had was the train, because it just felt like that image was being overused quite a lot in the media. In my field, I mean, the thing is, I've spoken to James via email. You know, he was asking me questions about some stuff he saw in Syria.
You had been in touch with James Foley yourself before he had been captured?
Yeah, just before he disappeared, he had been sending me video clips of cluster bombs being used in Syria. They're incendiary cluster bombs, and he was asking me about them because it was the first time they'd really been used in the conflict. And we were just exchanging emails back and forth, and he was asking me what they were, and I was telling him what I knew. And as for my own safety, you know, I'm certainly not going to be taking any holidays in Syria or Russia in the next few years, but, you know, I'll just say stay safely in Leicester, I think.
It's been such a hard time for journalists in places like Syria. There's a sense now that it's too dangerous to really cover these stories that are vitally important for the world to understand. And your approach fills some gap in that knowledge. Where do you think this kind of data collection and sorting and the kind of things you're doing, where do you think it's really going?
I think there's a great value for it for different organizations. I mean, you look at media organizations. It was very interesting when we were doing our work on MH17, how many media organizations took our work and then went, you know, instructed their journalists on the grounds to actually investigate what we had found and confirmed what we had found, which they were able to do. What I think may happen in the future, if you're a media organization and you aren't figuring out how you're going to work with this, you're going to start getting left behind by the organizations that do. Because there's a lot of information out there that will make very, very good stories that just isn't being looked at. It's as simple as that. So I think, you know, there's all kinds of different uses for it. And I think in particular, media organizations need to think seriously how they're going to use this.
Elliot Higgins is the founder of Bellingcat, a site for citizen journalists covering conflict. Elliot, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Later on the world, how social media is changing the art of diplomacy. This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Carol Hills, and you're listening to The World. The Texas National Guard has been busy lately, deploying troops to patrol the state's border with Mexico. It's part of a law enforcement surge ordered by Texas Governor Rick Perry to increase security along the border. Perry says the extra manpower is needed to stop the illegal flow of drugs and immigrants north from Mexico. Local reaction to the National Guard deployment has been mixed, as Monica Ortiz Uribe reports.
Working in law enforcement along the South Texas border is anything but boring. On this sizzling August afternoon, a Chevy sedan has just crashed into a signpost across the street from a junior high school. Cop cars surround the scene. A handcuffed teenager ducks into the back of a squad car as plainclothes police heave bundles of marijuana into the back of a pickup. Sergeant Brian Witt explains it was a routine traffic stop turned drug bust.
The vehicle evaded. The driver started throwing bundles out the window.
Sergeant Witt is with the Texas Department of Public Safety, or DPS, the State Highway Patrol. He's here as part of Governor Perry's surge operation, which has state troopers posted at about every 3 miles along this highway.
One of the reasons DPS is down here to help arrest these criminals that are doing things like this, hauling dope into the United States, also smuggling humans in.
The South Texas border is currently the busiest corridor for illegal crossings. More than half of all immigrant arrests happen here, an average of 400 per day. Add to that a wave of more than 63,000 Central American children who have crossed the border since October. All this has overwhelmed federal and local law enforcement.
We're low on resources. We do need support.
Ruben Villarreal is the mayor of Rio Grande City. He welcomes the extra set of eyes. Smugglers, he says, are tricky and try to blend in.
The best police work, the most effective police work, is when you're doing the simple things. When you use the ability to notice something out of place, that's when you usually capture or come across illegal activity.
Now, 1,000 National Guardsmen are deploying to work alongside local, state, and federal agencies. Their mission is to deter crime through surveillance, but they can't arrest anyone. Their presence will cost the state $17 million a month. Hidalgo County Judge Ramon Garcia says that's too expensive and adds it's just the wrong response.
When you militarize this area, you're sending out a certain perception that this is a high-crime area when, in fact, it's not.
Garcia's seat is in the city of McAllen. Its violent crime rate is lower than the national average. But Sam Miranda says it's not that simple. He heads the FBI in McAllen and says statistics don't tell the whole story, particularly when it comes to drug cartel activity.
That you see a lot of violent crime or a lack thereof doesn't mean that the cartels are not integrated into your community.
Some examples. In 2011, an alleged cartel boss was stopped by police on his way to the Texas coast, where he owned luxury property. In a nearby county this August, sheriff deputies stumbled into a 2-acre pot farm. Before that, a former border sheriff pleaded guilty to accepting campaign cash from a convicted drug trafficker.
That's like an iceberg. Most of the ice is underneath the water.
But Graciano Gamino, who heads the narcotics unit, says this problem is best confronted by local law enforcement, not the National Guard.
Those resources and that money can come our way to buy equipment, training, have more personnel on the streets and stuff like that.
Back at the drug bust, across from the junior high, a mother, Yvette Trevino, looks on as cop cars leave the scene.
I appreciate them being here. All these drugs and these gangs, and we are dealing with this every single day. You know, you feel protected when you have the state troopers here.
But many locals agree the extra police won't stop illegal traffic, only push it to some other spot along the border. For The World, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe, reporting from McAllen, Texas.
In Spain, they're mourning the passing this week of one of the country's most popular musicians. His name was Pere. Not a household name for most Americans, but our friend Beto Arcos remembers him well.
Long before the Gypsy Kings, there was Pere.
Ay, burriquito como tú.
Pedro Pubil Cala, better known as Pere, was a gypsy singer, guitarist, and composer from Barcelona. In the mid-1950s, he created a new musical style called Rumba Catalana. It's a high-energy cocktail of musical flavors, including flamenco, Cuban music, and even a little rock and roll. Starting in the late 1960s, Pérez's recordings made Rumba Catalana one of the most popular Spanish music styles, in Spain or anywhere else. I remember listening to Pérez's songs on the radio in the early 1970s in Mexico. A couple decades later, I found out that the composer of a song I used to sing with my brothers, El Muerto Vivo, the Dead Alive, was none other than Pérez. One of the special qualities of Pérez's songs was the witty and very often humorous lyrics. El Muerto Vivo is a perfect example. The lyrics tell the story of a man who wasted his salary on booze, and since he didn't come home after a week of partying, everyone assumed he's dead. But no, no, say the lyrics, he wasn't dead, he was just drinking a few beers. In the 1980s, Pérez left the music scene and turned to religion, even joining an evangelical church. But he eventually changed his mind, making several comebacks. Then, in early 2000, Pérez invited a number of international artists to record an album featuring many of his big hits. Among the guests was David Byrne, singing Pérez's hilarious tune called Si Fulano.
Now if this guy were that guy, and then that guy was that guy. Si Fulano fuese Mengano,
si Mengano fuese Fulano.
I saw Pérez in concert in 2007 at a festival in Cartagena, Spain. I remember how captivated and respectful people were when he took the stage. He sure knew how to entertain and make people happy. Just to give you a sense of his stature in Spain, here's what another respected Spanish music figure, Kiko Veneno, wrote about Pérez on his Facebook page. One cannot be any bigger, inventor of a musical genre, a poet, a singer of truths, a happy life maker. I never get tired of telling young people to listen to your songs. Since the 1960s, you shook up Spain like the Beatles. But you were ours, an innovator, truly possessed by the power of art. All that and more was Pérez, el rey de la rumba. For the world, I'm Beto Arcos.
Te repartí con el pobre lo que él no puede gastar. Se acabaría la envidia y también la vanidad.
Si fulano fuese mengano, si mengano fuese fulano, si fulano fuese mengano, fuese sultano.
News headlines are next on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Carol Hills. The guy who invented Hello Kitty had a very specific goal.
What he wanted to create was a Japanese cat who would go after the American mouse.
Mickey Mouse, that is. But the company behind Hello Kitty now says she's not a cat. We find out what that's all about ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The battle over Ukraine is being fought on many fronts, and I don't just mean on the ground between Ukrainian, pro-Russian, and now Russian forces. It's also happening on Twitter. This week, Canada's NATO delegation got in on that front, tweeting a map with this message. Here's a guide for Russian soldiers who keep getting lost and accidentally enter Ukraine. The map showed a red Russia beside a blue Ukraine-shaped nation that was labeled not Russia. The tweet drew an equally snarky response from Russia's NATO Twitter account. Nick O'Malley teaches at Harvard's Kennedy School. He's also the author of The End of Big, How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath. I asked him for his reaction to the idea that Twitter is now a tool of diplomacy.
Well, I think we've seen a real change over the last decade in the way our traditional institutions, the institutions of diplomacy, institutions like NATO, the way they communicate and engage. You know, in the past, you really had to operate through much more formal channels. And technology has been and continues to be disintermediating, removing the intermediaries and allowing really a much more direct and frequently a much more casual exchange between lots of different parties that used to operate through more formal channels.
And I should add that it's not just Canada and Ukraine. Samantha Powers, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., she retweeted that exchange. So the U.S. is getting involved, too. Do you think this kind of war of words on Twitter, is it good or bad for diplomacy?
I mean, I think that it's indicative of overall that the way we used to do things is changing and we haven't established new norms. I mean, 10 years ago, it would be not just unthinkable, but frankly impossible for the ambassador of the United Nations to suddenly have a gigantic online audience of the general public, as well as leaders and decision makers in multiple institutions. And today, Twitter gives officials like Samantha Power that kind of access, that kind of immediacy and accessibility without necessarily all the traditional checks and balances, without the norms of, that our institutions used to carry. Our institutions developed ways of doing things over decades that tried to codify important things about diplomacy, for example. And we're living in a world where those norms don't always make sense. And even if they do make sense, there are faster, easier ways of getting to the point.
Do you think anyone in high levels of diplomacy take tweets seriously? Is it entertainment or is it real communication?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that there is definitely an entertainment quality about it that is made possible by the intimate personal nature of the technology. But I also think that these words carry weight. Words usually do. And they impact relationships in a variety of ways that are sometimes hard to codify. You know, I mean, I think if we look back 25 or 30 years to the careful way that diplomatic statements were wordsmithed and people read so much into individual statements, you can see that that world is increasingly a thing of the past.
Now, you teach at Harvard's Kennedy School. What do you tell your younger students who are so active on social media about this kind of communication?
I think that the important lesson for my students is about the way that technology empowers individuals and the way it shapes leadership, that the challenges of leadership are different than they used to be, that there is an enormous amount of transparency in some ways in what happens, and also a kind of a real personal nature to it that creates new kinds of challenges for leaders. It's much harder to have diplomacy and negotiations behind closed doors than it used to be.
Nick O'Malley of Harvard University's Kennedy School, thanks a lot for speaking to us.
My pleasure.
By the way, we do our own digital diplomacy. We're on Twitter, at PRI The World. When the U.S. military pulled out of Vietnam, it left something of a living legacy. Babies, fathered by American servicemen during their time there. Many of those babies and their Vietnamese mothers lived in poverty after the war, and the U.S. government eventually took steps to help some of them. But this isn't an issue confined to Americans in Vietnam or even to wartime. It's also a side effect of some United Nations peacekeeping operations. Amy Bracken sent us this report from Haiti.
Sasha Francesco Barrios is 5 years old. She lives in the seaside town of Port Salut with her mother's family. Her mom, Roselyne Duperval, says Sasha's father was a Marine in the UN peacekeeping mission in Haiti, known by its French acronym, MINUSTA.
They came here, and there was one who was friends with me. He said he loved me and we were together. I never thought if I stayed with him and had a child with him that he would leave and not support the child.
But she did get pregnant, and she says the Marine, who's from Uruguay, gave her $200 early in her pregnancy, but he left Haiti before Sasha was born, and she never heard from him again. Now she's living with her mother, scraping by.
They come in our country to help us, and they don't help us. They have kids with us and leave. I need aid for my child to pay for school. We need the UN's help. There are no ministers' troops leave babies here, children without dads.
She says us because she knows other women in the same situation. In February, the UN brought seven mothers, including her, to the capital with their children for DNA tests. Now the seven mothers are still awaiting results. A Uruguayan military official said the alleged fathers have been asked to submit DNA samples. If paternity is established, it will be up to the Uruguayan courts to determine what should be done about it. Of course, establishing paternity and getting child support are also a challenge when the dad is a local Haitian. But community activist Myriam Duclair says it's much harder when the father is a foreign peacekeeper.
The difference is if it's a Haitian dad, often his family will help the mom. But when a foreigner leaves a child, there's no one to help. When the UN talks about coming to Haiti to stabilize, it's not true. They come to destabilize.
The UN does have a policy of helping facilitate paternity claims and child support in these kinds of cases, though it's ultimately up to the country where the peacekeeper is from to determine follow-up. But Uruguayan Army Colonel Gerardo Frigosi says no matter what the circumstances, relationships between UN peacekeepers and local people are never acceptable because of the power imbalance.
There is no possibility to any relation, consensual or not. It's very clear, the policy in that point, because the power is in the UN soldier, because they have food, they have water, they can provide security, they have money.
Sylvain Roy of the UN's Conduct and Discipline Unit makes it even clearer. He says it's exploitative.
Regardless of the fact that the mother may have been consenting, the relationship is exploitative.
Rosmina Joseph was 16 when she became pregnant, she says, by a 35-year-old Uruguayan peacekeeper. She doesn't describe her relationship with him as exploitative, but it's clear that the food he offered was part of the draw.
The peacekeepers would provide protection and they help kids here. They would give them a little food and all that. And they were always giving to me, too.
She shows me a photo of herself and, she says, her peacekeeper boyfriend on her 17th birthday, standing behind a cake and a table covered in food. But she says after he left Haiti, he eventually stopped picking up his phone and sending money. An official back in Uruguay says the alleged father agreed to submit to a DNA test. If he's proved to be the father, the case will be decided in a domestic court.
I want minister to get me out of poverty, to put me and my child in a better place.
It's a common wish, but Joseph is in almost uncharted territory, even if Uruguay is doing something about it. A UN report from earlier this year says, to the best of their knowledge, quote, there is yet to be a single paternity claim acknowledged through judicial actions in any troop or police contributing country. For The World, I'm Amy Bracken, Port Salut, Haiti.
Amy's story was produced in partnership with 100 Reporters, a nonprofit investigative news organization. Breaking news, this just in, Hello Kitty, that iconic white cat with a red bow, she's not a cat. Nope, not a cat. I know, I can hardly believe it myself. But here to confirm it is expert anthropologist Christine Yano. She wrote the book Pink Globalization, Hello Kitty's Trek Across the Pacific. So Christine, Hello Kitty is not a cat. What's that about?
Well, you know, she's never shown on all fours. She's standing, she's sitting like a human. But I am curator for an exhibit at the Japanese American National Museum, which opens in October. And Sanrio, of course, is a full cooperating partner in this.
And Sanrio is the company
that makes Hello Kitty, absolutely. And I wrote the script for the museum exhibition. And in writing that script, I talked about Hello Kitty as Sanrio's feline, or I mentioned her as a cat. And that script came back with corrections from Sanrio. Hello Kitty is not a cat.
Well, what is she then?
Well, she's supposed to be, and I'm going to speak Sanrioese here. She's supposed to be a girl, a friend, an icon. And in the Japanese sense, Japanese call it a kyarakta, which we would transliterate as character, but it means a lot more in Japan.
So why is she called Hello Kitty if she's not a cat?
Hello Kitty is her name. Like, it could have been maybe Hello Carol.
Oh.
But her full name is indeed Kitty White. She is half of a twin. Her twin sister is named Mimi. She likes apple pies. She's a perpetual third grader.
She's a perpetual third grader, but she's turning 40.
Exactly. So, I mean, you know, that's the kind of sense of humor. That's the kind of sense of fun with which I think Sanrio imbues this character, Hello Kitty, in the name of a kind of amusement.
Now, you've mentioned Sanrio a couple times, the company that created Hello Kitty. Tell us about the founder, Shintaro Tsuji, who created Hello Kitty.
A lot of what Hello Kitty stands for, a lot of what Sanrio stands for, comes directly out of Tsuji, Mr. Tsuji. He describes his childhood as somewhat lonely. He went to a Christian kindergarten. They had things like birthday parties for children, and that was not common in Japan. That's not part of Japanese tradition. But he loved that. He loved that kind of individual attention, and he took that individual gift-giving and brought it into when he formed his company, what became Sanrio.
Where did Hello Kitty first appear in Japan?
She appeared first in Tokyo stores in the form of a very small coin purse for children. And you can't imagine, Carol, just how small this coin purse is. It's like the coin purse that spawned an empire. And on that clear vinyl, there was this image of a cat sitting. Of course it's not a cat. A quasi-cat sitting. And it's a side view, but she's facing toward what in effect would be like the camera.
So how did Hello Kitty then make the leap from being hugely popular in Japan to being this global, iconic product?
Whenever we think about Tsuji and Hello Kitty and global, we have to understand that Tsuji's ambitions were always global. He idolized Walt Disney. And in some ways, he thought what he wanted to create was a Japanese cat who would go after the American mouse. So he created this character, his designers created this character in 1974. By 1976, she had already made the leap across the Pacific, but she had made it in terms of ethnic enclaves, like shops in Chinatown, shops in Japan-focused areas. She wasn't an immediate success globally, not at all. She was a success amongst Asian Americans, who saw in something like Hello Kitty, this, you know, very cute cat slash girl, something that they could relate to. This was theirs. And from there, it expanded through various means, a distribution means, more globally.
Now, you've been studying Hello Kitty for some time. I'm sure you've seen some pretty wacky interpretations of her. What are some of the most outlandish ones you've seen?
Hello Kitty Fender guitars, Hello Kitty motor oil, Hello Kitty makeup by Sephora. The other thing to note is that Hello Kitty has been, say, pirated by fans who then customize cars or who might customize guns, AK-47 rifles, Airstream trailers with Hello Kitty. That co-optation by fans and sometimes critics have expanded the breadth of where Hello Kitty might appear.
So finally, do you love Hello Kitty?
I've come to appreciate Hello Kitty. Is that a good hedge?
That's diplomatic.
as most diplomats are forced to do. You know, every time I think I've seen everything there might be to Hello Kitty, the company comes out with a new product, and it's another oh my God moment for myself.
So you mentioned there's an exhibit about Hello Kitty that's going to be in Los Angeles starting in October. I'm sure there's tons of objects, Hello Kitty objects. Do you have a favorite one that's going to be shown?
Well, I am thrilled that we are going to be exhibiting the Lady Gaga gown. So this is a gown made up of Hello Kitty plush toys, sewn together, things like that.
Wow. Christine Yano is the author of the book Pink Globalization, Hello Kitty's Trek Across the Pacific. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Hello Kitty.
This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. More at TiVo.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. The news on climate change can be mind-numbing sometimes. Melting ice caps, rising seas, droughts, floods. We're constantly hearing about all that. But once in a while, something jumps out that really grabs you. For us here at The World, that something this week was one word: irreversible. It was a big theme in the latest draft report on climate from the UN. It was leaked to major news outlets, and the report warns that we're looking at severe and irreversible impacts from climate change by the end of this century. And that got us wondering, what does that really mean? Our own environment editor, Peter Thompson, is here with me. And Peter, what does irreversible mean when it comes to climate change?
Well, it doesn't mean irreversible for all time. I mean, in the long term, big changes happen in the Earth's climate. And, of course, have ebbed and flowed back and forth between hot and cold for thousands and millions of years. But the IPCC, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that wrote this draft report, and it has not been released yet, but it's based on a huge volume of work that was done earlier. They basically define something as irreversible when it takes much longer for nature to undo a change than it took for us to cause that change to happen in the first place. It basically means that for many of the changes we're causing in the climate system, there's no going back to the way things were before on, and this is key, on a meaningful human time scale. We're talking about big changes in the climate system that you and I and our kids and our grandchildren and likely generations beyond will never see undone.
So how do scientists conclude that the path we're going will create irreversible damage?
The basic thing comes down to what happens to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and what happens to heat in the ocean. Carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere a really long time. It can take hundreds to tens of thousands of years for carbon dioxide to work its way out of the atmosphere. And we're putting a huge amount of it in there, and it's going to stay there for a very long time. That traps more and more heat. That's the basic process by which climate change is happening. And that heat, we talk a lot about surface temperatures, but most of that heat is actually going into the oceans. And the oceans have this incredible long-scale process of grabbing and holding heat. And that's essentially going to lock all that heat into the global climate system for thousands of years.
So sort of a mini example of that is the beginning of the summer, you know, the lake or ocean's cold. Beginning of the fall, it gets cooler again, but the water's still warm.
Yeah, anybody who's lived by a lake or by the sea understands the way that works, that the air starts getting colder, but the water stays warmer, and we'll have snow a few miles inland. We'll have rain on the coasts because the ocean is holding that heat. And that's a very local, small example of the kind of thing that's happening with the oceans and climate now.
So what can we do about it?
Well, we can stop. And we can suck it up. I mean, we can't suck it up. People are scrambling, working on some kinds of technologies that can suck carbon dioxide back out of the atmosphere. There's really nothing that can do that now that's at all feasible. So we have to stop putting all this carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. But then, as I said, even at that, we start sucking the CO2 out of the atmosphere. The heat is still in the system. There really is no going back to a certain degree.
Is there any plans in place by any country or internationally to reduce carbon emissions in a way that will make this not happen?
Lots of promises, nothing binding. That's the subject of these negotiations that have been going on for decades internationally and here in the U.S. There's a big deadline in the U.N. process internationally next year in 2015, in which we're supposed to say this is what we're going to do and this is how we're going to do it. A lot of skepticism that that'll actually happen.
Peter Thompson, the World's Environment Editor. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Carol.
Finally today, we're headed into the long holiday weekend. One last gasp of summer fun, right? And here in New England, that has to include a visit to the nearest seafood shack.
Scallops will be ready in two. Two orders of lobster and an order of clams. We need a lobster roll. We need two lobster rolls.
Lobster rolls. I love them. So does Chicago-based food writer Steve Dolinsky. He gathered that sound we just heard, and it's actually not from New England. Steve's sampling the lobster further north in New Brunswick, Canada. So I asked him whether Canadian lobsters look any different than American ones.
Not that different. I mean, if you looked at two different lobsters from both places, you probably would have a hard time telling unless you're a fisherman. They do harvest a ton. I found out that in the five eastern provinces, they harvested about 140,000 pounds of lobster last year. But, you know, if you looked at the map, you would see the waterway along the Atlantic does sort of extend up into this area. So it's not like you cross the border and all of a sudden you get a more polite lobster.
They don't observe the border. They don't start saying A either.
They don't. I don't think the lobsters do. I'm not sure about that.
Okay. So let's get to the heart of this, the lobster roll. How do they prepare them in New Brunswick?
Okay, well, first of all, a lobster roll, just by definition, it's not a sweet roll. It's not a cinnamon or a pecan roll, just for people who don't really realize that. It's a sandwich. It's basically boiled lobster. They clean all the shell and cartilage off of it, so you just have the lobster meat. And typically a sandwich is about 3 to 4 ounces, and they're stuffed into a New England-style hot dog bun that has flat sides on either side, so you can kind of griddle each side in a little bit of butter on a flat-top grill.
What about the ingredients in the lobster salad? Besides the lobster meat, what other elements?
It varies. It's sort of like a chili recipe. You know, everybody's got a little bit of different variation, but I have seen everything from quite a bit of mayo with dill and a little bit of celery. I prefer just a teeny bit of celery just for some crunch. But then I've seen, like, there's a place here in St. Andrews, there was one called The Gables I went to, another called The Clam Digger, and very simply dressed, salt, pepper, a teeny bit of lemon juice. In fact, I went to visit The Clam Digger, and I spoke with Andrew Jacobs, the manager, and he kind of talked me through the construction.
Mix it up with just enough mayonnaise, like real mayonnaise, not dressing. You got to have real mayonnaise in a lobster roll, maybe a touch of butter. There's not much secret to it. Keep it lobster, keep it fresh.
So what's the scene like there at the Clam Digger?
Kind of what you'd expect kind of on the eastern shore. You know, clam bellies fried. They've got beautiful Bay of Fundy scallops fried. And then a lot of lobster rolls and just sort of, you know, French fries. And by the way, I should point out that the lobster rolls I've seen in New Brunswick are much more modest and a little bit more diminutive and, dare I say, a little bit more polite than their American cousins, because they're just not quite as hefty. I mean, a lobster roll in Canada I've seen averaging $10, and typically in Maine they're $15, $16. I mean, in Chicago they're $24, and they're heaping. But up here they have a nice ratio. As my son put it, it's got a good bun-to-lobster ratio, which I think is important.
They're tidy. They're tidy. They're not going to spill all over your front.
Exactly. They're very tidy, and they don't come with a lot of extra nonsense, and there's not a lot of extra filler. As Andrew said, it's just a teeny bit of mayo and a little bit of lemon juice, and let the lobster speak for itself.
Food writer Steve Dolinsky munching his way up the coast of New Brunswick. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Hey, you betcha.
Want to see some Canadian lobster rolls? You know you do. We've got some of Steve's photos from New Brunswick at PRI.org. And that's all from us today. Our theme music is composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Marco Werman is back next week. Have a great Labor Day weekend.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. PRI's New Voices Fund, whose donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers, and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. By the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor. The PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation. By the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Noor Hall. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.